From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, a pair of reports about the fraught relationship between India and Pakistan and rebellion on the Arabian Peninsula. The Pakistani army is battling Taliban militants along the northwest frontier with Afghanistan. Despite the widening influence of the extremists on Pakistan's soil, many Pakistanis perceive their eastern neighbor, India, as their biggest security threat. From Islamabad, NPR's Julie McCarthy examines Pakistan's preoccupation with India.
To appreciate the enduring animosity between Pakistan and India, you could do no better than to visit the Wagha crossing for the lowering of the flags on each side of the border at dusk. This daily ritual draws hundreds of Pakistani spectators on their side of the border, shouting at hundreds of Indians crammed into bleachers on their side. As the crowd bellows, "Long live Pakistan," black-clad Pakistani rangers stomp closer and closer to their Indian counterparts, heels clicking. Brinksmanship as entertainment. A brusque handshake between Pakistani and Indian officers, and the gate closes for the night on an enmity that is as old as the 1947 partition that created Muslim Pakistan out of Hindu-dominated India. The ceremony sums up the mutual suspicions with which defense analyst Hassan Askari Rizvi says each side regards the other.
India doesn't trust what Pakistan says or Pakistan does. And Pakistan is at times paranoid.
Paradoxically, some Pakistanis indulge in all things India, from its fashion designers to its movies.
I could fall in love with someone like you.
I mean, I'm kind of perfect.
The Indian film Wake Up Sid draws Lahore's young upper middle class that identifies with this story about the coming of age. As the credits roll, 19-year-old Rafia Aslam says whatever divisions exist belong to the older generation.
I actually genuinely feel that there are very few people amongst the new generation, you know, who feel hostility towards India, because we genuinely don't, and I don't think Indian citizens feel it either.
But historian Mubarak Ali says Pakistan cannot truly compete with its much bigger neighbor and has compensated by focusing on national security.
You know, this is our mistake. So that's why we are lagging far behind.
Army spokesman Major General Attar Abbas readily acknowledges that the bulk of Pakistani ground forces faces India.
All the troops that we have are basically meant to confront India, to stop India, who have a huge forces in the conventional army. So all our forces are geared for that.
The United States wants Pakistan to concentrate on fighting the Taliban, not India. And Abbas says the army has diverted 120,000 troops to the western border with Afghanistan to combat militants. But he says Pakistan's defense doctrine is based on the demonstrated capability of its huge rival India, and not on what others may tell Pakistan about the intentions of India.
If somebody is trying to convince us, look, where you see on the east is not a giant, it is just a pygmy there. So don't worry about that pygmy. And see on the other side, there is a growing giant there. But, you know, the state, any state for that matter, would say, no, man, this is real. You know, this giant is very, very real.
Newspaper editor Najam Sethi says even though the Taliban may be the existential threat, the media and most Pakistanis believe that India remains the most potent danger.
Whole generations have grown up with this mindset. It's not going to be easy to turn this clock back.
Here Here at the government Gulberg High School for Boys in Lahore, where the day begins with a national anthem, there is a near unanimous view of India as the other. It is admired on the cricket pitch and for Bollywood blockbusters. But in the social studies classes of 16-year-old boys, there seems more suspicion than curiosity about their rapidly progressing neighbor to the east.
Raise your hand if you would like to see India, if you would like to go to India. Is anybody interested in going to India? Nobody. No.
Textbooks have been rewritten since 2004 to remove the more egregious descriptions of India, excising such phrases as crafty and conniving Hindus. But education expert A.H. Nayar says students are still taught to regard India as a hostile country.
And continuously think of Pakistan and oneself as victim of that hostility. This is something which gets ingrained in young minds.
Author Ahmed Rashid says most Pakistanis have not yet realized that India may be less interested in perpetuating regional antagonism than it is in projecting global power.
They like to assume that they can play catch-up, that they're equal to India, that the world should treat them on par with India. These are all very outdated paradigms, if you like, from the Cold War.
But Noor says Rashid, has India made any effort to mollify Pakistani concerns?
It certainly wouldn't cost India much if it was to start a dialogue on Kashmir.
India and Pakistan have twice gone to war over Kashmir, and a dialogue on the territory that has been in dispute since partition does not seem to be on the horizon. The terror attack in Mumbai a year ago scuttled any hope of that. India blamed the rampage on the banned Pakistani militant group Lashkar-e-Taiba. Before it was outlawed, the group had close links with Pakistan's intelligence service when it launched a guerrilla war in Kashmir. Members of Lashkar-e-Taiba are on trial here for the Mumbai attack, but founder Hafiz Saeed is free to deliver fiery sermons at Friday prayers in Lahore.
Jo chahe kare, humne inshallah Allah ke deen ki baat aur Allah ke rasool ki baat kehni.
Pakistan detained the cleric in the aftermath of Mumbai. But prosecutors said there was insufficient evidence to hold him. Saeed tells followers at an overflowing mosque, "We are preaching jihad whether anyone likes it or not." Najam Sethi says groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba were once considered strategic assets for Pakistan, but they have now become a huge liability capable of launching more Mumbai-style attacks.
There are too many rebel elements out here, loose cannons, floating around who are quite capable of doing things on their own. This is a legacy of the last 30 years. We've created monsters which are going to take time to go away.
Pakistan's prime minister lamented this past week that at a time when the government is committed to combating extremists, the country's forces are overstretched by perpetual tensions with India. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Islamabad.
Pakistan's government and army are often accused of focusing far too much attention on India, despite the threat posed by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But what about India's view of Pakistan? From New Delhi, here's NPR's Philip Reeves.
Some stories still sound new and shocking many years after they were first told. The partition of India is one such story. No one knows exactly how many people died in the communal bloodletting that followed. Some say more than a million. Santosh Madhok was there.
Every other person was so sad, crying, the children, and the trains were full.
Madhok is 81. She remembers the hurried departure of the bankrupt British as they folded up their empire. She remembers a multitude of Asians on the move, Hindus and Sikhs fleeing the newly created nation of Pakistan, Muslims trudging across the landscape in the other direction. She remembers the pain that lingered on in her family for years afterwards.
My mother was all the time in a trauma. She could not stop weeping.
Madhok, who's Hindu, grew up in Multan, now a city in Pakistan. She and her family fled to India, travelling by train from the border area to the capital, New Delhi. That train ride usually takes 6 or 7 hours. This time, it took 4 days. The train kept stopping.
You know, they could not move because their bodies were lying across, because the bodies had to be cleared. They were firing across, and every now and then they would say, "Please lie down, because the bullets are crossing." So the mother would say, "Lie down, quickly lie down."
That was 62 years ago. Since then, India and Pakistan have fought three wars. They've both built nuclear arsenals, and they've become locked in a relationship rooted in rivalry and suspicion.
I actually feel that we give too much time in our mind to Pakistan.
Rahul Gandhi of India's ruling Congress party thinks it's time for attitudes to change. Rahul's mother, Sonia Gandhi, is the party's president. His father, Rajiv, was a former prime minister, and so was his grandmother, Indira, the daughter of Nehru. Both were assassinated. Many believe Rahul will one day lead the nation, a nation he'd like to see spending much less time obsessing about Pakistan.
We are now becoming a serious international player. Pakistan is a very small piece of our worldview.
Many analysts believe India's biggest foreign policy challenge these days is its rivalry with China. Changing attitudes about Pakistan isn't going to be easy, though. The subject dominates India's news media, which often makes no attempt to disguise its bias.
Now, it is indeed the most preposterous accusations of all. Pakistan Interior Minister has accused India of backing the Taliban. Now, a television
it's
interview...
hysterical. I think it's absolutely, totally unprofessional.
Seema Mustafa is editor of India's Covert magazine.
I think the television channels have actually, you know, forgotten that they're journalists and they become like advocates for war.
Mustafa argues the relationship between India and Pakistan is a paradox.
At the individual level, it turns into a whole lot of camaraderie. And at the political level, it is akin to hate.
Mustafa says even Indians who take a hardline stance on Pakistan sometimes display a strangely contradictory view.
People who have been sort of going hammer and tongs about nuking Pakistan, of taking your army across and finishing that country, are people I have seen visit Islamabad and be even friendlier with the Pakistanis. The families all start visiting each other, big gifts are taken, and then after that they come back and say the same thing.
In 2004, India and Pakistan started a peace process and opened up some trade and transport routes. They came close to a framework agreement over Kashmir, the territory at the heart of their dispute. It lost momentum when the then Pakistani leader, Pervez Musharraf, ran into political trouble at home. Then this happened. 1 year ago, a team of militants sailed in from Pakistan and attacked India's commercial capital, Mumbai. After nearly 3 days of sieges and gunfights, they'd killed more than 160 people. A few days later, thousands of Indians took to the streets of Mumbai to protest. Pralad Kakka, a leading advertising executive in Mumbai, was among them. Kakka says the crowd was more angry with India's politicians for failing to protect the country than with Pakistan. He still feels that way now.
We should look within ourselves for the answers to what we our problems are, not look at Islamabad. Islamabad is not a superpower.
Kakka believes Indian attitudes towards Pakistan have since hardened.
Today, I don't think there is any sympathy for Pakistan in India, whether it's among the Hindus or the Muslims, to be very honest. Because they are so alarmed by what's happening in Pakistan. They just see the state sliding into chaos.
Gopalapuram Pattasarathy, a former Indian senior diplomat who served in Pakistan, says the Mumbai attacks were a turning point.
Deep down, there is a sense within the country that we can't go back to business as usual with Pakistan until they act decisively against the perpetrators of the Mumbai attack. And more importantly, close down what we call as the infrastructure of terrorism.
After the Mumbai attacks, India's government froze the peace negotiations, officially known as the Composite Dialogue. India's since signalled it's willing for the dialogue to resume, but only if Pakistan takes effective action against the Mumbai attackers and other militant organisations on Pakistani soil. Pattasarathy says Pakistan's current campaign to root out the Taliban is not enough.
The Pakistan military has targeted only those radical Islamic groups which have challenged the writ of the Pakistani state, but are still retaining as their own instruments groups which are targeting either Afghanistan or India.
Afghanistan is a big source of friction. India is spending more than $1 billion a year there, much of it on infrastructure projects. That alarms Pakistan, which fears India's extending its influence to its western border. India's accused Pakistani intelligence of a role in last year's deadly attack on its embassy there. Some in India are opposed to renewing peace talks with Pakistan on any terms.
The composite dialogue has no potential for resolving these problems.
That's Ajay Sani of the Institute for Conflict Management in New Delhi.
Any of the problems between India and Pakistan can only be resolved by an alteration of the equation of power between the two countries. It is power politics that will decide these things. Nothing on the table can be negotiated.
More than 60 years after partition, India and Pakistan are still struggling to find a way to live peacefully side by side. And Santosh Madhok is still haunted by the memory of her terrible train journey. She believes the time's come for India to look to the future, not the past.
Well, it's better to forget. One can do nothing about it now. So that's better to forget and forgive.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
Coming up, war in Yemen.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. It seems the only time the rest of the world hears about Yemen is when a crisis spreads beyond the borders of this ancient land tucked into the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula. These days, it's a battle against Shiite militants in the north, which has drawn in the Saudi military in a rare use of its armed forces. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Sana'a that the conflict escalated in part because of divisions within the Yemeni army.
Reporters are barred from the conflict zone in the northern Sada'a governorate, but residents of the capital are used to the sounds of fighter jets heading north to the battle. The often contradictory claims of success by the Yemeni government and the rebels have been impossible to verify. The rebels, known as al-Houthis after their leader, say they've shot down three Yemeni fighter jets since October. Yemeni authorities say the planes suffered technical malfunctions and crashed. Yemeni officials have claimed the battle was nearly won, only to be followed by President Ali Abdullah Saleh saying that the war has just begun. One thing is clear, the conflict has left tens of thousands newly homeless, on top of the estimated 150,000 displaced by the fighting since 2004. In the overcrowded Mazraq camp in northwest Yemen, displaced farmers and shepherds swap stories of the fighting that mix straightforward observation with superstition and Houthi mythology. Abu Tariq, who fled his home near the Saudi border, says even the Saudi army, fighting to reclaim territory seized by the rebels on Mount Dukhan this month, was surprised by the Houthis' firepower.
The Houthis were there in Mount Dukhan, and then they had confrontations with the Saudis. They have secret power, some kind of magic. I mean, those guys are very strong. God knows what they have. They scared even the Saudi soldiers.
The Saudis soon regrouped and say they are now clearing a 6-mile buffer zone inside Yemen, an unusual overt military operation by a foreign power that so far has aroused no official complaint from Sana'a. Ahmed Al-Kipsi, a political scientist at Sana'a University and a member of Yemen's ruling party, says the rebels are mainly a criminal gang, although some of them, members of the Zaydi sect, an offshoot of Shiism, want to bring back the Zaydi Islamic government that ruled northern Yemen for nearly a millennium until it was overthrown in 1962. He says what's most troubling are suggestions that Shiite-led Iran is supporting the rebellion. He believes there's only one reason Tehran would do that.
Saudi Arabia. They'd like to upset Saudi Arabia. It is a Saudi-Iranian conflict in Yemen.
The theme of a proxy war has been taken up by international analysts and officials. In his column at foreignpolicy.com, analyst Robert Haddock wrote that Saudi leaders, quote, might fear the creation of a pro-Iranian Shiite enclave adjacent to the Red Sea shipping lane, similar to what Iran has achieved with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Other commentators warn that Yemen has been so weakened by its various crises that it's becoming a safe haven for al-Qaeda terrorists. Ahmed Saif, director of the Sheba Center for Strategic Studies in Sana'a, says periodic alarms about Iranian weapons reaching the rebels have so far not been backed up by evidence. He does believe financial aid, either from Iran or sympathetic Shiite groups, is getting through. But to answer the question, where are the Houthis getting their arms, Saif says you need look no further than the divided and dispirited Yemeni army.
They are buying the arms from the Yemeni army, from the local market. Because the catastrophic situation of the traditional army here and the lack of loyalty to the state, they don't have the, you know, the momentum to fight. Yeah, so they simply just sell their ammunition and the arms.
A Yemeni official confirmed this account, speaking anonymously for fear of reprisals against his family or career. Echoing the U.S. State Department and others, analyst Ahmed Saif says there is no military solution to Yemen's northern conflict, but he adds that it will likely take Saudi pressure to bring the two sides back to the table.
Actually, the one who has the final say is Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen. The war is not the answer. The war is further weaken the regime, is further disintegrate the state, and make it optimal situation for Al-Qaeda.
Add to this crisis a struggle against separatists in the south, a potentially crippling water shortage, and a rising tide of refugees from Ethiopia and Somalia, and it's easy to see why Yemenis say they need help, not fear and condemnation from the international community. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Sana'a.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.